dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has become rather adept over the years in ferreting out interesting bits of intelligence and sharing them with us appropriately, I think, on matters involving the various threats to our country is, I'm very pleased to say now, a senior analyst for defense policy at the Center for Security Policy. His name is John Rossomondo, and something that he published at the center's site, securefreedom.org, caught my eye the other day, in which he was talking about something that actually was quite relevant to the debate that took place between the former Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, and the incumbent President of the United States, Donald Trump. And it was captured in that debate as, you know, where does the military stand? Did Trump say something contemptuously about them? And him responding, no, I've got 250 flag and general officers who have endorsed my candidacy. I'm not going to ask you to parse all of that, John, but I did want to say it's an interesting backdrop for some insights that you had in talking with four general officers recently about the threats we're facing. Give us a quick précis of who you spoke to and what they're talking about, which is arguably, as far as I'm concerned, the single most important, certainly national security issue in this debate, in this presidential election, the choice that the American people will be making about how the next commander-in-chief will deal with the Chinese Communist Party and the threat we face from it. Tell us about those flag officers.
Thanks, Frank. I spoke with two Democratic admirals, former Admiral and Congressman Joe Sestak, spoke with Admiral James Winnefeld, former Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Brigadier General Rob Spalding from the U.S. Air Force, and with Lieutenant General Tom Spar over at Heritage, and he's a former Army general. They all were in agreement that we've lost the eye on the ball as far as the rise of China. We've been over-focused on dealing with the counterinsurgency efforts that we've bungled over the past two decades. Meanwhile, China has been exponentially increasing its technical capabilities, coming out with the new stealth bomber in a few months. It's been radically increasing its fleet. Back in 1996, we sent two carrier battle groups when the Chinese threatened Taiwan, and that caused the Chinese to decide to upgrade their military. We no longer enjoy military supremacy. In fact, several war games done at the Pentagon show that we would lose a war with China. And all four of these flag officers saw that we're losing the fight, and we have no leadership in the Pentagon.
This is alarming, of course, not necessarily news to those of us who have been tracking what the Chinese Communist Party is up to or listening to Secure Freedom Radio, I'd like to think, but alarming just the same. And one of the things that I think you took away from your interaction with Admiral Winnefeld, and I'm not sure it's fair to call him a Democrat, but you know, he was certainly prominently featured in the Defense Department during the Obama years. But I think it was he who said something to the effect that we'd be reduced, given the disparity now that has been allowed to emerge between China's military in the Pacific and that of the United States, which has forces in the Pacific, of course, but many scattered elsewhere all over the world. would be kind of all we could do should China actually act on its threats and, in fact, its increasing seeming preparations for an invasion of Taiwan to, quote, send our condolences to Taiwan, unquote. Talk about that.
Correct. Right now, the Chinese have been drastically building up their naval and marine forces to assault Taiwan. They would overwhelm Taiwan with a barrage of missiles, bomber strikes. Just last weekend, or the weekend before, wasn't clear, the CCP mouthpiece, the Global Times, reported that the People's Liberation Air Force conducted drills aimed at sinking the Taiwanese Navy and destroying a major Air Force base on the north end of the island. And, back in 1996, we could have just completely overwhelmed them. Not anymore. The Chinese are developing anti-ship ballistic missiles that could incapacitate a carrier. I don't know whether it would necessarily sink it, but it would basically take the carrier out of the game and make it impossible for us to launch fighters. Our fleet would be threatened by overwhelming number of anti-ship missiles. So we don't have the capability as of yet to completely overwhelm the Chinese, or at least do what we would have been able to do 15 years ago.
And one of the things, and I don't know if this came up in your discussions with these general officers and flags, John Rossomondo, but it's been very much a focus, as you know, of the work we've been doing at the Committee on the Present Danger, China, is to point out, and if we can, to try to stop the underwriting of this Chinese buildup, both the military kind and also in so many other ways, the intensification of the threat we face from the Chinese Communist Party and its military through transfers of wealth from American investors to Chinese companies that are, in some cases, actually part of the military-industrial complex of the PRC. Did any of these officers address that, or any thoughts you might have on that subject?
I mean, Admiral Winnefeld especially was concerned about the connection between U.S. economy and Chinese economy, and spoke a lot about the size of their entanglement with our economy. We didn't have that with the Soviet Union. I mean, the Chinese are a much graver threat to us than the Soviet Union ever was, because now they don't really just have to go and hack in. In some cases, we'll just give them the technology, or at least our corporations will.
Which has dramatically contributed to the erosion of our qualitative edge, as they've been able to bring to bear lookalikes of our own frontline weapon systems before we have even gotten them off the drawing board in some cases. John, we have to leave it at that. Good work on this investigation you're conducting now here at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again soon. We'll talk with you in a bit. Next up, we'll talk with Diana West, a bit deeper dive on what happened in that presidential debate last night and what it might portend for this country, and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back for one of the high points of our week, which is our visit with the inimitable Diana West, longtime syndicated columnist, a blogger at dianawest.net, the author of three fabulous books, The Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and The Red Thread. Diana West, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back. Well, I'm hoping that you will be able to help us make some sense of what all went on last night in the course of the presidential debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden.
And Chris Wallace. Yes, the other debater. I think he was running the Biden strategy over there. I mean, all we had were these horrible social justice warrior questions. I mean, every question seemed to come from the point of view that Donald Trump was wrong about every subject, whether it was the Green New Deal, Antifa. I mean, it was everything came from a left perspective, but worse than that, of course.
Critical race theory, no less.
Critical, absolutely, very important one. But the mechanics of the evening were basically Trump being interrupted by Wallace, and Trump being interrupted by Wallace to when he was making a point, and Trump being interrupted by Wallace when Biden was trying to talk over him. I mean, this is kind of a Rorschach test here on how you watch the debate, because of course the media has a completely flipped idea, but they did before it started. So this was just an amazing display. In some ways, it was a Chris Wallace's night. It made I don't know, Candy Crowley from years ago looked practically nonpartisan. It was extraordinary.
And that's an important reference for those of us who are not of a mind to recall it. But Candy Crowley, basically from CNN, helped Barack Obama thwart a very important line of attack that one of the few, I have to say, that Mitt Romney used against him. And she did so falsely, obviously with cueing from, you know, the control room, but it still was a direct intervention. And so when you saw Chris Wallace doing that, I mean, to be fair, I think the president got a fair number of interruptions in as well. But the point is, I think you're saying Chris was essentially shaping the debate, the questions, among other things, but the shaping of the debate in a way that disadvantaged the president, and that amounted to a highly interventionist role for a guy who was supposed to be simply the moderator. So what did you make more broadly of the content of the two candidates' positions? It's been observed that there wasn't a whole lot of real content from Joe Biden. There were a lot of talking points, but Trump was trying to actually bring, I think, some more substance to bear at various points in the conversation.
Well, Biden probably did best when he started talking about his Trumpian program to bring jobs back to America. I mean, that was a weird moment, but in general terms, I mean, it was not really a content kind of night. This was a political struggle. It wasn't a real debate. They usually are not. But in terms of what we were watching on the stage, it was I was just kind of fascinated by that notion that every time Joe Biden or Donald Trump made a very important point about Joe Biden, we saw Chris Wallace shut it down, or we saw Joe Biden say, "You're lying," and then Chris Wallace didn't press Biden to explain. I mean, this was on the Hunter Biden scandal. We saw this it just kind of unroll on some of the kind of truly the sort of looming issues that are over the Biden campaign in terms of this massive corruption that has been the press is doing so much to suppress. And I think that in some ways is really what set the tone for Chris Wallace's protection racket that we saw in terms of stopping Trump from making, I mean, yes, you're right, the president made a lot of points and the president interrupted a lot. I mean, it was a free-for-all up there, and I think he did marvelously well and held his ground magnificently on so many occasions. So, but it was more about what they would let them talk about.
Donna, before we run out of time, let me quickly turn to two other things that I know you've been thinking about, both of which featured in the course of this debate. One is the issue of election fraud. The president was asked about it and came down squarely on the side that it is happening, it has happened, and it is going to happen, he thinks massively, in the course of this election, which could delegitimate it. Joe Biden, on the other hand, and Chris Wallace, it seemed, were pretty much dismissive of the problem. And yet we have, just this week, Representative Ilhan Omar, who I think it's fair to describe as a serial criminal perpetrator in various roles and ways. But in this particular instance, she seems to, or her campaign at least, has been caught by Project Veritas engaging in, you know, the vote harvesting of uncast ballots in ways that simply they were bragging about using for electoral fraud purposes. Your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are this sort of open wound that our country has become, in the sense that we are looking at evidence of massive voter fraud, in this instance being uncovered by a fantastic, stellar journalist by the name of James O'Keefe, not a U.S. attorney working on behalf of the American people from the Department of Justice. I mean,
though the president has said that needs to happen.
I know he said that needs to happen, but that is not, in my view, what, looking at the mechanics of this administration, it is not going to happen. The Justice Department is, as far as I'm concerned, quietly and stealthily going rogue. I mean, this is the fact that James O'Keefe has to come upon this and break it to us as best he can, with the media squelching him and the left squelching the story and the political machine trying to, you know, capitalize on it, is a scandal upon a scandal that is hard to even wrap your brain about. This is an assault worse than even the Trump Russia, everything else we've come up to. The assault on the ballot is the absolute worst thing you can do to our democracy. The assault on the election is the basis of the function of the democracy. And the fact that there is no policing of this except to alert the people. There's a Paul Revere named James O'Keefe, and there is no legal structure in place to actually protect the ballot, to execute against the perpetrators of fraud, which is not unique to Minnesota. We know this is widespread in many city centers, and we have no authorities on the job. And that is why you look at Trump and you see that he is a man, a president does not, I don't believe, function with full presidential power. He draws his power from MAGA, and that's why November 3rd is so important to him, and he will get an outpouring, I think, unprecedented in terms of, you know, I don't know about numbers compared to numbers, but just I think he will get a wave, a tremendous renewal of his mandate, and that is what he needs to overcome all of the corruption and also to overcome his own institutions, his own too many in his own administration, and he needs to reassemble, first of all, the Justice Department, the FBI, basically from the ground up, in if he gets a second administration and is able to execute.
This will be something we'll be attending to much in the days ahead, and I know with your good help, Diana West. I do want to say about Ilhan Omar before we move on, there is a terrific book about her various machinations entitled American Ingrate, which really talks about how she has effectively taken over sort of the Democratic Party's agenda on so many things, and it's required reading, American Ingrate. Let me just turn to another issue, Diana, which is very much related to your body of work, namely the enemy within problem. There was talk about it yesterday in the course of the debate, in which much was made of, and has since the event been made of, Donald Trump's alleged affinity for white supremacism. He was actually called a racist himself by Joe Biden in the course of the conversation. But this whole Boogaloo Boys business is now causing all kinds of thrashing. Talk a little bit about, well, both that piece of the story, but also Kamala Harris, the running mate, though sometimes she's top of the ticket, it seems, of Joe Biden, is actively throwing in with Black Lives Matter. The vice president kind of bobbed and weaved a little bit on that. He didn't denounce Antifa or Black Lives Matter, but has not been really called out for having failed to do so, other than by the president, of course. But just give us a flavor, Diana, as you see it now, of where we are on this whole question of the rioting in our streets and its implications in the context of the debate and beyond.
Well, that was huge. I mean, maybe that was the biggest takeaway of the debates, in that the Biden would not denounce Black Lives Matter or Antifa. And I mean, this pairs perfectly with Kamala Harris's active cheerleading for them to discuss the rioting, the looting, the violence, and so on, the attacks of law enforcement in the context. This is Kamala Harris talking about these protests, quote unquote, being essential for change in the United States. She is saying that revolution in the streets is essential for revolution in the United States. I mean, this is not to use the word essential too often, but this is basically what the message she is making very clear. And it was very important for Biden not to alienate this hard left wing of their political movement, that is at this point with Ilhan Omar in the political system, essentially leading the Democratic Party to a hot, fevered pitch of of, you know, what Robert Conquest called the residual muck of Marxism-Leninism. But, I mean, this is their ideology, and they are there to implement it if they do get into power. So this was a huge, huge failure on Biden's part. And I wouldn't call it a failure. It is a huge strategy of the Biden-Harris ticket to stay aligned with the whole BLM Antifa revolution that has been going on for the past month.
Which really is the driving force behind all of this, no matter how much talk there is about white supremacists or Boogaloo Boys. It is all about the left, and the president has got that exactly right. Dinah, thank you so much for your time today. Come back to us again soon. I know we'll be mulling this debate for a while, and I look forward also to your insights into the next one coming up with the vice presidential candidates. We'll talk about that next week. Until then, Dinah, thank you. Keep up the great work at dinahwest.net. Next up, we'll talk with Brian Kennedy. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by a man that I have come to regard not just as a great comrade in arms and freedom fighter, but dear personal friend. His name is Brian Kennedy. He has, in the past, served with great distinction as the president of the Claremont Institute and publisher of its world-renowned review of books. He is these days the president of the American Strategies Group and the chairman of the, I believe, hugely important Committee on the Present Danger, China, which I'm proud to be his wingman and vice chairman. It's so good to have you with us, Brian. Thank you for taking a few minutes to catch up a little bit, most immediately on last night's presidential debate and some of your recent work on the China front as well. Good to have you back. Let me ask you about last night. The president and the vice president respectively addressed China. It wasn't supposed to be on the agenda exactly, but since they were going to talk about the Chinese Communist Party virus, it was inevitable. And of course, it was brought up in several contexts, including President Trump's quite insistent attacks on the vice president's son, Hunter Biden, and the extraordinary amount of money that he was able to get the Chinese Communist Party's operatives to give him to invest, and the kinds of purposes for which that investment was made. Give us your thoughts sort of in the macro, and then we'll get into some of the particulars about the debate last night.
Yeah, in the I thought it was such a weird debate overall. I mean, that's a specific point that needs to be made, even though it sounds kind of general. Nothing seemed very clear about any of it. The president pushed him on Hunter Biden, and I think there's ample evidence now that Hunter Biden received this money. This is not disputable that Hunter Biden received money from the Central Bank of China to invest in his investment fund. That part is not disputable. And so the mere fact that the vice president could so glibly dismiss that all of this had been somehow disproved, I think he said, or something to that effect, that, I mean, I think the vice president was just openly lying and Chris Wallace was letting him get away with it. And the idea that a vice president's son could tag along with his father to China and afterwards receive a large investment from the central bank as if that had no relationship to the kind of things that went on with the vice president negotiating with the People's Republic of China's actual leader, Xi Jinping, that's just so far-fetched. And Chris Wallace let Joe Biden say that and get away with it.
Well, not only that, as Dinah West pointed out earlier in the program, Brian, Chris Wallace kept sort of intervening to interrupt President Trump's efforts to make the point that this really is factually established, and the vice president's efforts to say this is all discredited, completely unfounded charges was really interfering in the course of the debate and the substance of it, not the role of a moderator, one would think. Let me ask you about one particular piece of this. And under your leadership, the Committee on the Present Danger China has done, I think, incalculably important work on exposing the degree to which our capital markets have been transferring immense amounts of money, by some estimates, $3 trillion of it, to China, underwriting effectively all kinds of dangerous activities and programs and initiatives of the Chinese Communist Party. One of the things that was not explicitly mentioned, but that was going on in the immediate run-up to Hunter Biden getting $1.5 billion to invest on behalf of the Bank of China, as you know, Brian, was a bilateral memorandum between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party that made a lot of that transfer of wealth possible. Talk a little bit about that and why this really makes this question of what was Hunter Biden doing and what did his father know about it and all the rest really materially important, strategically of great consequence to our country and our security.
Yes, well, I don't, thank you, Frank, for that question. I think that's absolutely right. When Vice President Biden was in China at that time, I guess it was 2013, he was negotiating a memorandum of understanding that would essentially allow Chinese corporations to have access to U.S. capital markets, but not to have to disclose any of their auditing within their companies. And so there'd be very little, there'd be no disclosure, just as a practical matter. And it almost defies comprehension that the U.S. government with Vice President Biden would allow trillions of dollars to be accessed here in the United States, taken from the United States and brought to China to invest in their corporations with absolutely no disclosure of the auditing of those companies. You get a glossy folder saying invest in company X. When you actually want to look at what the finances are, they're not there. And it's against the law, against Chinese law, to even show them to you. Yes, state secrets. And the mere fact that after agreeing to all that, within 6 months, exactly 6 months, Hunter Biden's investment fund receives $1.5 billion from the Central Bank of China, as if that was had no relationship, when in fact, that looks like an open bribe. And anybody with two eyes would see that.
As has been observed by some of our friends, Brian Kennedy, it's a commission on what was arranged in that memorandum of understanding, namely access to perhaps as much as $3 trillion. $1.5 billion is not a bribe. That's something else. But Brian, let me just ask you this, because what you've described here is really not just, you know, corruption on the part of Vice President Biden, but it has translated into an immense intensification of the threat that we're facing from China. And so, as you know, you're spending a lot of time on this subject, of course, through the committee's work and your own. But to the extent that what we're witnessing here, the choice that the American people will have to make in short order has to be, at least in part, informed by an actual understanding of where do these candidates stand on the question of China. Arguably, I think the most important question that they will be, you know, voting on in this coming election, or certainly the most portentous one, depending on what choice they make. How do you see, Brian, the choice that is before us?
Well, it really is the case that President Trump has been working these last 3.5 years to end the economic war that the PRC is waging against the United States. He, in fact, has staked his entire presidency on it and has done, in my estimation, a brilliant job. He still has a lot to do, for sure, and the committee has given him some very sound recommendations. But he's done a brilliant job in moving the American people and the American government to take on communist China and all their nefarious activity, from the threat of intellectual property to the accessing of our capital markets with impunity. Going back to Joe Biden, it would be more of the same of what we saw prior to President Trump. It would be unfettered access to our capital markets. It would be the theft of intellectual property, and it would be the exploitation of all of our companies who are trying to do business anywhere in the world, but most especially in China. I don't think it could be any clearer, the two different sides and the contrast that you could draw when it comes to China. And I say that not in a, you know, overtly partisan way. I'm just trying to observe what are their two positions.
This is, I think, precisely the kind of clarity that we need to have, Brian. And let me just add that one of the other facets of all of this is that as things stand at the moment, the appetite of China to get still more money from us and to get in the process still more Americans, you know, sort of part of their lobby, in effect, because their life savings are tied up in Chinese investments, is hurtling down the tracks at us in the form of an initial public offering by the Ant Technology Group that is set by some estimates to raise $100 billion, much of it coming from American sources, you know, pension funds, other institutional investors, and individuals as well. If that were to happen, our colleague Roger Robinson has done some great work on this at the RWR Advisory Group, and I commend to everyone, rwradvisorygroup.com is a resource on Ant Financial Group and this IPO and undisclosed material risks associated with what it's doing in this IPO. These are the sorts of things that we need help with. We need corrective action. We need a president who understands that this is a threat to our security, our freedom, maybe our currency, and more. And Brian Kennedy, your leadership on these issues at the Committee on the Present Danger of China is indispensable, and we appreciate it so much. And I know you'll both keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to talk more about it in the very near future. Next up, we'll speak with Peter Husey about a staggering idea that the Democratic House of Representatives has come up with. How about we put another $170 billion from the U.S. taxpayer into communist China? Stay tuned for more.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by an old friend and colleague, the president of Geostrategic Analysis and the director of the Strategic Deterrence Studies Project at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. His name is Peter Husey, and he has written a piece at the National Interest recently that just made my head explode, and I think it will yours as well. And I'm delighted to have him on to talk a little bit about it. Peter Husey, there was a recent continuing resolution or appropriations bill that has been put forward by the House of Representatives, and I'm sure there's all kinds of crazy stuff in it, given who's running the place these days. But talk to us about this specific provision that was introduced at the last minute and on a party line vote. Talk a little bit about this International Monetary Fund initiative that the House Democrats are trying to perpetrate.
As many people may know, the International Monetary Fund provides loans to countries around the world without any indication of how bad they are or good they are. And the pandemic has, of course, hurt a lot of countries. We're talking about trillions of dollars in lost GDP. And so the House Rules Committee, which determines what legislation can reach the House floor, brought up a bill that was going to fund the government for the next year. And that's pretty standard. But just as they were sitting down to look at the bill, the chairman of the committee decided to insert a new section in the bill that added, and this is the number, $3 trillion, not million, billion, trillion, into the International Monetary Fund, what are called drawing rights, meaning they go to bank and say, hey, we get this amount of authority to grab this much money, pay up. America traditionally pays about 25% of the IMF bill. That's not the part that really is amazing, is that under globalism, as they call it, the UN and the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, they give money to everybody. North Korea gets money, Vietnam gets money, Cuba gets money. It's like we're all the same. And as you know, $3 trillion would go to a number of countries. And what was fascinating is this wonderful congressman from Michigan, Bill Huizenga, said, wait a minute, I would like to offer an amendment on the House floor saying none of this money that the IMF is going to get comes from American banks. It was ruled out of order by the chair in the House, on the House floor, and it was also voted down, in was not even allowed to be offered in the Rules Committee. It was considered out of order.
So, Peter, $3 trillion in some kind of authority from the United States Congress. Now, it hasn't become law, obviously, and probably won't. But Peter, I mean, that's a staggering sum of money. I mean, we've become somewhat accustomed to these sort of things going down without too much debate because they've been COVID-related in our own country. But this is a horse of a very different color. They're talking about doing these things for the purpose of helping these various other countries pursue, you know, COVID protection programs, of course. But still, you're talking about $3 trillion. And just give us a sense, Peter, of the kind of money that's going to some of the most odious countries on the planet.
Yeah, this is what Bill, the congressman, decided. He said, well, wait a minute, how much does Iran, Venezuela, Syria, China, and Russia get? And he figured it out, and I think it was kind of amazing. Here are the numbers. $20 billion for Iran, $75 billion for Russia, $170 billion for Communist China, and $17 billion for Syria, and I think about $5 billion for Venezuela. Well, whatever they may do with the money, you know they're going to do some bad things, which includes building IEDs and blow up American soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Chinese communists are going to, you know, militarize the islands in the South China Sea, build ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons, and China and Russia is undergoing right now the largest nuclear modernization in its history. So whether you like it or not, this money would go from the IMF to these countries. Now, the Senate staff who run the committee that have to deal with this told me the Treasury opposes it, the Republican majority leader, Mr. McConnell, opposes it, and the Democrats looked at it in the Senate and said, you've got to be kidding me. But the point is, we have a system where whatever the IMF gets, there are very few rules that say, no, you can't give to country X because they're a rogue nation or a bad nation. And so whatever money they get will come to countries that are doing us harm. And 25% of it at least comes from American banks.
And just to put a fine point on it, Peter, what you're telling us is that under a Democrat controlled House of Representatives approved piece of legislation, still has to go through the Senate, would still have to be signed into law by the president, so it's several steps away. But still, it speaks volumes about the leadership, starting with Nancy Pelosi, doesn't it, of the Democratic Party in the Congress, running two houses of that branch of government, that they would actually envision putting $170 billion of U.S. taxpayer funds, possibly, you know, augmented or supplanted maybe by some others around the world, but conceivably all of it, our money, going to the country that perpetrated the, what I call, CCP virus on us and the rest of the world. This is just unbelievable.
Yes, and the thing is that as someone who worked at the United Nations years ago, when I was going to graduate school and law school, the UN works on this crazy system where everybody is meant to be equal, irrespective of what they do in their own countries. That's off. You're not meant to go there. And the problem is, as you know, they have the Human Rights Committee in the UN that does probably 90% of the time condemns Israel. And so it gets very skewed. And the American media, American academics, the foundations, politicians, by and large, let it go. You remember Jean Kirkpatrick, one of the things she did was draw attention to this, and this administration has done likewise. But we get kind of, you get a sense that the House says, well, we need to help some countries in the world that are desperate for help because of the coronavirus. Understood. Well, then, because we want to help them, we got to help everybody, even those people who are busy trying to kill us and undermine us and then destroy us economically and so forth.
What you appreciate, of course, is that money is fungible. And as you said, people who have no regard for, you know, either using monies for the purposes that they solicited the funds, to say nothing of regard for our interests, would be only too happy to have us underwriting their military buildups designed to threaten us.
Well, exactly. And this is Mike Pillsbury's point in his book, 100-Year Marathon. It's the president's point with respect to the JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran. As part of that, we had $150 billion in escrowed money that had been sanctioned because of oil sales from Iran that they didn't get. So we gave the whole thing to them, yet you have a court decision here in New York, a number of them, and in Britain and elsewhere, where Iran has been found guilty of criminal acts and terrorism that has killed Americans, and they owe us, the courts came up with a figure of $55 billion. I would have withheld at least $55 billion from that, but as John Secretary of State Kerry admitted, the money was given to Iran, and it is fungible. And he said, yes, some of it's going to be used for terrorism. And my view is, I don't care whether you like the nuclear deal or not, but the last thing you want to do is give these guys $150 billion of funding money, which they're going to give to Hamas and Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad and fund the wars they have in Yemen and Syria and against Israel and against America.
And the last time I checked, Peter, the president, including in last night's debate, referred to the disastrous idea of giving $150 billion to Iran, which, of course, is what the Obama-Biden administration did with John Kerry and everybody else. But here you have another $20 billion that would go out.
Well, it's even worse than that. Remember, during that period, just before the nuclear agreement was signed, the Hezbollah, created by the Iranians in 1981-82, they were smuggling more cigarettes into and out of inside America than any other mob organizations. They were selling drugs and they were trafficking in women and children for sexual purposes. And they had a FBI and the Treasury Department were ready to arrest these guys and finally put them in the slammer. The Obama administration said, no. Go away. Don't do it. We have to have this deal with Iran on nuclear stuff, and so we can't put Hezbollah in jail. And that's news. You can go pick it, go Google it. It's been in the New York Times, been in other major, the dominant media. So this is not something I'm making up. Is that we basically gave them a break, and we then said, oh, you want a $150 billion check? Fine. Here, you get this. Oh, by the way, we'll admit that we supported a coup in 1954 when, in fact, we didn't. So if you remember, the Obama administration of Biden went out of its way to curry favor with the Iranians who were busy killing us.
Peter Husey, so much more to talk about. We have to leave it at that for the moment, but we're going to come back to you about this sanctions business, the snapping back that the administration is trying to do, and the advantage that our enemies will take of collaborating with Iran to our detriment, among others. Peter Husey, thanks so much for your time today. Come back to us again soon if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.